Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Thriving Adoptees podcast. So today I'm delighted to be joined by a lovely lady. You're in for a real treat. I say that a lot. And I say this a lot because it's true, right? We only have people with huge hearts on the show. So, Laurie, welcome to the show. Looking forward to spending the next hour or so with you.
Hi, Simon. It's wonderful to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. So could you introduce yourself to the listeners, please, Laurie?
Yeah, I love that you use the word heart because that's kind of been a focus of mine. My name is Laurie Holden, and about 9 years ago, I wrote a book with the help of my daughter's birth mom called The Open-Hearted Way to Open Adoption, How to Help Your Child Grow Up Whole. And the premise of this book is that adoption creates a split in a person between their biology, the DNA that we're born with, and their biography, the life that's written by the people we call family. And one way to help integrate and heal those two, that separation, is through open-heartedness and through openness between adoptive parent and child. So it's a little bit of a twist on the, you know, more modern concept of open adoption, which means having contact. The deeper and more complex, more important, more impactful piece is this openness that adoptive parents can cultivate with their child. And it happens by doing our own work, by making a clear channel within us as adoptive parents between our head and our heart.
Yeah.
So you asked for an introduction. I got kind of sidetracked there, but I also host my own podcast called Adoption the Long View, directed at adoptive parents who are willing to look past the wedding of filling their arms with a baby and towards more the marriage of the long-term adoptive parenting challenges that come up, not just at the beginning when they're a baby, but, you know, when they're a toddler, where they're school age, when they're young adult or adolescent and young adult. My two children now are baby adults. They are adults, but they're very new at being adults. And so I've been doing this a little bit a while. We have played with in the arena of contact with all four of my children's birth parents. It has looked like a kaleidoscope at times where come in and out, and there's lots of variables that affect our relationships there, and we roll with it and we talk about a lot of things. And then I guess the last thing about me is that I write at my own blog that's been going for almost 15 years, lavenderlose.com.
Wow. Fantastic. The you said head and heart, right? I mean, for me, what you just said was a perfect example of that, because the love just comes through, right? The open heartedness, the fact that's the name of your title of your book, but it comes through from you, but from the head point of view, you've also got that precision. The precision in your language, which is what we're really after, isn't it? It's that when we're trying to communicate something in a book, on a podcast, it's all about coming from the heart with clear. So I'm struggling now, and I'm talking about clarity of communication on I'm an R-ing, okay, so I'm on the learning curve here too. I'm on the learning curve here to clarity. I also think that some people, I hear this in adoption circles, there's so much obsession with psychology and trauma. And, you know, people say, well, love isn't enough. And I often think, well, it may not be enough. I'm not sure whether I actually believe that or not. If it's not enough, it's got to be the place that we start from. I remember I got my adoption file about 6 years ago. So this is the file from the council. So it's here in the UK, adoption is largely a public sector phenomenon. And my mum had wrote a letter, my adoptive mum, my mum wrote a letter to the agency like 3 days after they collected me from the agency, and they said, "We love Simon very much." And so they'd obviously fallen in love pretty quick, you know, because this is like 3 days after the event. So if love isn't enough, it's got to be the right place to start. And I feel that the love angle of this, and what you're writing about, the open-heartedness nature of this, is sometimes kind of crowded out by the more psychological approach that seems to be the narrative for me in the adoption world. But that's just how it seems to me. Does that ring true for you?
Yeah, I think being human is a lifelong process of bringing together opposites. We deal with dichotomies and polarities all the time. And in adoption, that is just enhanced. And I talk a lot about the shift that adoption practice and policies made toward the end of the 20th century from this either or, you can only have one family. So we're going to tuck the first family away, put them behind a wall. You'll never find them because you can only have your current family. That's what we were kind of saying to adoptees, to adoptive parents, to birth parents. And we shifted, we're still making the shift. We've made it in policies in some places to allow the adoptee to have both their first family and their second family. And it, not only legally, but in their hearts, it's okay to wonder about your first family. It doesn't mean you love your second family any less. So that's one of them, shifting from an either or to a both and. But I think we do this in so many other ways. Adoption has tragedy in it and trauma, but it also has gain and love. And we can feel really sad about something at the same time we're feeling grateful for the same thing. We have to, and this is kind of the marrying of the head and the heart that I talk about. When the heart is built for wholeness and connection, and the head is built for discernment and distinction. And we need both of those to build our healthy boundaries, because we are all both an individual and we are part of a group. Maybe that's just a family or a wider community. So how do we discern those boundaries? How do we love fully, starting with ourselves, and protect ourselves, you know, with wisdom? How do we have the wisdom and the love in each moment of our journey with other people, our adoption journey with other people?
Yeah. The how-to question.
Yeah, yeah. And it's this ongoing marrying of head and heart, I think.
The how question is a head question, yeah?
Yeah, and it dives into it dives from the head to the heart, and the heart needs to inform our decisions. That decisions is a split thing. You know, we're deciding this or this. That's an either or. When we're deciding on contact, deciding on, you know, in the moment, how are you going to handle it when your child says, you're not my real mom. I'm not going to do what you say. You're at a decision point there. Are you going to handle this from a healed place, or are you going to handle this from a wounded place? If you've done your work on that, if you have healed maybe what you came into the situation with, your own childhood, your own experiences, then you can make it into a response. If you haven't done that work and you have not healed from that hurt place, you're going to have a reaction. And you're not going to really make a decision, because it's going to come out automatically. You're not going to have that moment of saying, I wonder what I can do here.
Sounds like you've learned this yourself, yeah? You've learned this through the contact sport. That, oh.
Yes, I have yet to meet an adoptive parent of a child older than 7 who hasn't heard, "You're not my real mom." And often it is just the child pushing a button to see how they can gain control over a situation. That's human. We all want to kind of control our own destinies. They don't want to clean their room. They want to find the key to not having to comply and clean their room. And it could be that they are thinking about their first mom, their birth dad, their, you know, somebody. They are thinking about adoption, but we don't know yet if we haven't had that conversation, you know? So that conversation could look like this. "What do you mean I'm not your real mom? Who made you breakfast this morning? Who's going to drive you to soccer today?" And your child has reduced you to a 6-year-old because you have not taken that moment to discern. You felt hurt, just like when the doctor taps you with a little hammer on your knee. That reflex makes you jump. The alternative, the discerned way, if you have been building this clear channel between your head and your heart, and if you have been working on your own wounded places, could be, I'm pretty sure I'm real. Here I am. I'm pretty sure fake mom didn't make your breakfast this morning. So nice try, buddy. And you could also say, yeah, and Kelly's real too. Your other mom is real too. You have two real moms. That's the both and. Now, I wonder if you're thinking about her today. Would you like to talk about it? And so in this case, instead of disconnection, you have built in a moment of connection with your child. And that's what it's all about anyway, is that wholeness, that integration, that connection, and feeling like a safe person to your child to have their feelings.
When did you realize that you need to do your own work?
I don't think there was a moment. I think I've just always known that. I don't know if you're into the Enneagram, but I'm a 4. So I have lots of feelings. And I spent the first part of my life trying not to have the feelings, and that didn't work so well. So at some point I realized that the feelings weren't quite as scary as I thought they were when I was keeping them down. They aren't scary if I let them move through. Emotions in motion, as a wise therapist once told me.
What do you say? Your motion what?
Emotions in motion. If you let them move, and I think of emotions like waves, like water. And if you let them move, they can, you know, they're more likely to move through you. If you keep them stuck, they gain power over you. And you don't even, it's kind of below the surface power. They're controlling you. You don't even know it. It's unconscious. And that's when you react instead of respond.
Yeah. So one of the realizations that I came to probably about 5 years ago is I was worried about being worried.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, the emotions were piling on top of each other. And becoming more, and to me, that feels like becoming more solid. And if they're becoming more solid, that sounds to me a bit like being stuck rather than emotion.
Yeah. Yeah. You want to have like a metacognitive, you want to be able to tune into how you think. You want to be able to think how you think, but you can kind of get into it too much, like being between two mirrors, and it just goes back and forth. You could think how you think, how you think, how you think, how you think, and then it becomes something more negative than positive.
So I had the guy that helped me see that. He talks about becoming morons, having more on our mind.
Mm. So how did you break that thought pattern?
How did I break it? I don't know whether I have. You said something about dichotomies earlier on.
Mm-hmm.
And a coach of mine who I used to speak to a lot. I say coach. You could call her a therapist. She's not a licensed therapist. I don't know what she calls herself. For a profession, she's not really into those sort of titles. But our calls start by they start with she says Och I the new, okay, which is a kind of a leg pulling statement that English people say about Scottish people. Och I the new, it's right. They don't say that, but we in our culture where we're joking about different parts of the UK. So she says, Och I the new, answers the phone with that, because the first time I spoke to her on the phone, I said, you don't sound very Scottish on the phone. So she, and then I repeat back in I say, hey up lass, which is a kind of a Yorkshire greeting. But again, very hammed up, very not real world, you know. And then she says, how have you been? And I say, up and down. And she says, me too, welcome to the human race.
Mm-hmm.
Because if we are, and the connection with that is that if we're okay with not being okay, yeah, if we're okay with not feeling okay, we're always okay. If we're not okay with feeling okay, we're always okay. This too shall pass. This emotion will be in motion, rather than being stuck with it. So if we're stuck with it, how have I changed, the worrying about worrying? I've changed the worrying about worrying by being less worried, by having an insight about the fact that my feelings can't hurt me.
Mm. It's a wonderful insight.
And I still fall for it, right? It's not a once and forever.
Right.
I still worry about worrying, but I worry a lot less about worrying, and I worry a lot less frequently, and the duration of that worry about worrying is a lot shorter. So you summed it up beautifully with those words from the therapist about emotions being in motion.
And I think if you are watching your own thoughts to the point where you can realize when you're worrying about worrying and name it, I mean, that's a huge step to just recognize, oh, in this moment, this is what I'm doing. And I can choose to let that kind of go. You don't hang on to it, you let it go.
Yeah. I think we, as a human race, we identify with our thoughts, right?
Mm-hmm.
We identify with our thoughts and we identify with our feelings. And it's always, so one minute I am happy, next minute I am sad. So what all our focus is on the feeling, which is a variable, rather than the subject, the I am-ness, which mm-hmm. is openness, spirit, infinite potential, who we truly are. We get very identified with our job roles, our roles in life, our roles in our family, something that happened to us, like I'm adopted, I call myself an adoptee only for shorthand. I used to say I was adopted. So we get kind of very focused in on, what's happened to us, or the role that we're currently playing. But that's not who we truly are, because that we haven't always done that. We haven't. A guy I'm listening to at the moment, he says, well, we're not our feelings, because when the feeling passes, we're still there. Which is a bit of a spin out. A bit of a spin out thing for me. When our feeling passes, we're still there. So we don't lose a piece of us.
You're asking,
we don't become less whole. We don't become less whole when a feeling goes.
Right. You're doing some big work around and asking some big questions around identity. Just who are we aside from the momentary feelings?
Yeah.
Who are we?
It's multi-levered level. Yeah. It's multi-levered. Well, the best description I've heard about of this is I talked about this on the podcast recording I did yesterday, actually. A rugby player from the English rugby team talking about, who am I? His first thought was, I'm the voice in my head. He tried to get a meeting with the guy that has the voice in his head, the speaker of that voice. He set the meeting and nobody showed up. And when he looked again in his head for the owner of that voice in his head, the negative voice in his head, all he found was a load of old beliefs, thoughts and beliefs. And when he saw past that, he discovered infinite potential. And that's who we are.
You're reminding me of that scene in The Wizard of Oz where, you know, the Wizard of Oz has this aura of being all powerful and awe-inspiring and awesome. And then you find out it's just a little guy behind the curtain, madly trying to hit the right button to get the right result. And then I do think that sometimes when we do this inner work to find out who is the voice in my voice, who's the voice behind this, who is making me behave this way, and you can start to uncover that, you find that it's not this awe-inspiring, hugely powerful thing. It's a scared little person madly trying to get the results they want.
Yeah. It's the angry ego that's shouting somebody down, isn't it? I was talking to somebody in the swimming pool, and she had been into a butcher shop and saw that the butcher was selling hares, you know, like rabbits. And they're an endangered species. And so she'd suggested that he shouldn't be doing it, generally. And he'd said, I don't need to justify myself to you. I think this was on an email. I think this happened on an email or a message on Facebook or something. And it was the ego coming back, wasn't it? It's the ego. Well, he didn't ask. This lady doesn't think that. She didn't ask him to justify himself, but he got defensive. His ego got defensive. He became the. Because there's two ways the seven-year-old child can go, right? It can go to anger, or it can go to despair. And blokes, men, just a massive stereotype, will often go to the anger stuff. I'm taking this a bit off subject here, but I think sometimes it's easier to see this stuff in other contexts and with other people. It's hard. Another mentor of mine once used a line that I love, which is, it's hard to see the picture when we're in the frame. And that's why doing our work involves a therapist, a coach, an author, somebody else reflecting a different view that may catalyze change within ourselves.
It's so that we can see ourselves from not only the inside when we're kind of doing this work, but also from the outside, like a more objective perspective of ourselves. Sometimes that's harder to get on ourselves, and we need help getting that.
Yeah.
From somebody who is outside ourselves.
Yeah. So what have you learned whilst doing your own work, Laurie?
I have found, a couple of things have helped me to continue to move more to a place of responding instead of reacting. Some of those are principles from DBT, dialectical behavior therapy, which is, and I'm not going to do this, but very well, people should look it up. But this is bringing opposites together. DBT is a therapy that's used for people who have big emotions, and it helps them, it helps us to make space for competing emotions and not be so afraid of emotions. And so there's a lot of, it's quite an extensive toolbox within that. Sometimes it's one technique is returning to your five senses. When you start to feel yourself spinning out, ground yourself by figuring out how your feet feel in your shoes, naming a few things that you see, naming a few things that you hear, just kind of bringing everything back to your body when your mind is spinning out. And so that's an example. And then I think a lot of things, leaving the DBT behind, because that's a huge subject, and it's well worth research into. But the second thing that I find myself resorting to often in adoption situations and in just my life is, the 12 step, the serenity prayer that is used in so many 12 step programs. And it's kind of what we've been talking about. There's two different versions of it, and I sometimes get them mixed up. God grant me the courage to change what I can. So courage is one piece, to make change where you need to accept what I can't change, and then the wisdom to know the difference. So that's just another way of discerning between, does this situation call for courage or acceptance?
So is that happening for you in a, the gap between stimulus and response, between some, a comment and a comment from a child from a place of hurt who's testing boundaries, and what you and how you respond? Is that what's
when I'm at the top of my game? Yeah, I don't always make it to that discernment place, but trying to wedge in that moment of deciding how you're going to, what you're going to say, how the stance you're going to take, the approach you're going to pursue, the action you're going to take. When I can make a moment to decide, it comes out, it just turns out so much more beautifully than if I'm just on that autopilot tapping my knee reflex, but I don't do it well all the time.
Me neither.
But, I'm experiencing this now, even on my parenting journey. One of my children has started her own life, and she's, on her own, and letting go of that is a journey for me to, even now, 20 years into parenting, figuring out how do I accept? The time for me to make change with her is dwindling, and now it's more about the accepting, and how do I do that on an ongoing basis, and how do I breathe through it? How do I, wish her well? How do I be there for her when she does need me? You know, all of those things. It's a new stage of parenting for me.
Yeah. Underneath the strategies, there seems to be a lot of depth to where you're coming from. Do you get what I mean by that?
Say some more.
So the how-tos, right? We're all looking for the how-tos. Our heads are definitely looking for that, for the how-tos. I'm trying to go for your dichotomies there. Non-contrast. There's a depth that you're coming from to me, which is far deeper than a strategy like, oh, remembering the serenity prayer when I'm facing a tricky situation.
Yeah, I think if nothing else, adoption as our playground is that this is where you and I live.
Yeah.
But this is something that all humans deal with. We just deal with it in this arena. Is so much more complex than adoptive parents were led to believe, possibly birth parents were led to believe. Of course, adoptees get this from very early on and they don't ever like move into it. That's just where they start if they were adopted as babies. So there's just such complexity here, and that is depth. There is not going to be an easy thing that makes everything better. There's layers and layers and layers, and underneath those layers are more layers. I have a yoga practice. I've been practicing yoga about the same amount of time that I've been writing on my blog. And there's so much in yoga for me that feeds this, that helps me deal with the complexity of being an adoptive parent and being human. The most simple, basic strategy that gets me to the other strategies is to take a moment to breathe and ground and move back into myself from wherever my mind has me to move back in here.
Yeah.
And if I do that on my mat once or twice a week, then I have the practice in my body for when I'm out in the world and experiencing frustrations in traffic and at the store and here in the home with my kids or whatever. That one moment can really make a difference.
And what do you find there underneath that?
When I find that moment to breathe, I can access a point where all is well, even if everything around me is flying, is chaotic. In this moment, in this place, all is well. I can sometimes find that decision tree of, am I going to change this or am I going to accept this? And I just keep breathing, and then I get an intuitive hit of which direction to go. I'm making it sound very simple, but it's not. It's a practice. It's something that you build and build and build day after day, moment after moment. And I'm not a master of this at all. I just keep practicing.
Are you talking about the yoga practice or are you talking more about
both? The practice of just breathing and being present in those moments of chaos. I can find order here if I take a moment to find it, to tune in.
And what do you find when you tune in?
I find that brief moment of stillness where I can make a decision. And that decision is to have courage to affect or to change something, to say something, to influence, or the decision to accept. That's putting in very stark terms.
Yeah. And what did you say? The brief moment of
I don't remember. I just, it helps me just to ground and find that clarity in that decision point.
Have you ever thought that that clarity is who you are?
I think I am the clarity, and I think I am the chaos. And, you know, that there's a Native American story about, like, there, I have a wolf on this side and a wolf on this side, which wolf will win? And it's the one you feed is the answer. So I think the more I feed that clarity, calmness, groundedness, the more that is who I am in that moment. And the more I feed the chaos, the more that's who I am in the moment.
Yeah.
But I certainly have the potential and the capability to be both, either and both.
Well, we're back to that identity piece, right?
Mm-hmm.
So have you heard of, have you read, did we talk about this last time, Don Miguel Ruiz? We talked about him.
He is the four questions. What is that?
Yeah, something like that. Yeah. He's got a few books. Funnily enough, I didn't like the four what's it at all, but I love the first 20 minutes of another one of his books. It's called The Voice of Knowledge. And the first 20 minutes are about, well, if we were to say peace, you found peace. And you said something like, there's a brief moment of peace. And in that, and in that moment, I have an intuitive shot of what to do. I think it's kind of what you said. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So if we were to simplify that to peace, right? And I said, is that peace who you are? And then you went to the, what's it, well, the, which wolf do I feel, feed? Don Miguel Ruiz on the, in The Voice of Knowledge, The Voice of Knowledge in the first 20 minutes, which is just like, so he's a Toltec, like he's the grandson of a Toltec shaman or something like that. So it's Toltec, it's Mexican rather than Native American Indian. Sorry if I've got the names wrong, people on that, on the listeners on the the correct PC terms to use for this. It's just ignorance. It's not out of badness. He talks about the unconditioned soul, which is then, and that's peace. And then the layering comes on top of that. So the conditioning, i.e. the rubbish we pick up from the world around us, the cultural conditioning that we all pick up, whether we're adopted or not, just like the whole thing. And so the essence of who we are is peace, using your word. And then on top of the peace are the thoughts, but we're not born with any thoughts, right? We pick up thoughts, we pick up feelings, we pick up cultural conditioning. But that isn't the essence of who we are. We're the peace that's underneath all that. And to give you another metaphor by a guy that I'm listening to at the moment, a guy called Rupert Spira, he talks about us being the screen. So on that screen, it's blank. And I know some people are going to say, well, some people say that adoptive kids aren't a blank sheet of paper and stuff like that. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about human consciousness, you know, who we truly are, our identity, our identity as awareness, our identity as consciousness, our identity on the screen, with the screen. We're not the movie that's showing on the screen. So the movie of our moment, the movie of our day, may be a horror story because we're going through hell. It may be a comedy. It may be like a family sitcom because we're having one of those days where nothing is going right, but we're laughing about it. But we're not the horror story, and we're not the sitcom with the screen sitting behind us.
What if we're both? What if we are the screen and we are the movie?
Well, he talks about this Rupert Spira guy talks about separating. So in the first stages of separating the movie from the screen, so going behind the movie to see the screen, and then coming back the other way to see that actually we are both. So you're spot on there. You're spot on there. Your question. But it's easier. He explains why he goes one way and then comes back the other. He creates the dichotomy and then he collapses the dichotomy. So he describes the separation and then collapses that separation. Because it's just easier to kind of get your head around it that way. And we're flipping back and forth between the two. But we are, most of us, I think, I'm speaking for myself here, actually. I'm very caught up in my thoughts and my feelings, and therefore for me it's kind of easier to explore the contrast, explore the dichotomy, than it is for me to embrace the unity. I think that's probably just where I'm at my learning. Fascinating stuff.
Yeah, we're covering a lot of ground. Very deep conversation.
And this is the way. It's in that depth that the changes happen. In my opinion, or not in my opinion, in my experience. Yeah. Mm-hmm. He makes a wonderful distinction. This Rupert Spira guy, he said, well, there's only two options in terms of belief. We can believe in our experience, or we can believe in a thought. He sums it up perhaps better than that. Trust, we can trust in our experience, or we can trust in our belief. And in my experience, what changes in doing our own work is when it's deep. Like it changes at the heart level, and then the head catches up. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, so the strange analogy, but hopefully a useful one. In the UK, the house builders, they build houses to sell, right? They don't build houses for people to live in. What the builder wants, the large scale house building contractor he wants or she wants that house, those houses sold fast as possible. And so they often have great curb appeal and big hallways, because you're attracted in by the curb appeal, and then you open the door and you see the big hallway and you're impressed, right? That hallway serves very little purpose after you've moved in. But we buy on emotion, the good feeling of a hallway and grandeur and then we justify that we're human. Yeah, we're driven by our emotions, and then the logic comes later.
There's a metaphor I'm seeing there, which is what social media, the impact social media has had on people, where we pay so much more attention to our curb appeal, how we look to others, yeah, on Instagram or wherever we are. And that's okay. We also need to be paying attention to the internal parts of us too.
Yeah.
Or we'll get it just gets too lopsided.
It does, and all those reality shows, all those dating shows, all those Love Island and these shows, which are all about show, show business. It's all about the show. What we're doing on social media divides, doesn't it? Because everybody's putting their best face on, and thinking, and we're comparing.
Our highlight reel.
We're comparing what's going on their outsides with what's going on in our insides.
Yeah, and to use your comparison, we can't forget that this is where we live. Ourselves are meant to be lived in, not just shown, not just sold for our appeal to the outside world.
Yeah.
So that takes care and tending. And to do that, for me, what has worked is to build a practice around it. I need that kind of structure to remind me to do it. So yoga helps.
Yeah.
Everybody, there's lots of ways, and people can find the ways that work for them.
Their own ways. It's finding the way that works for us in our own experience, isn't it? So you're talking about quite a holistic approach. You're taking a very holistic approach on this. Mm-hmm. So you're going head, heart, and body if you're doing yoga, I guess.
Yeah, and when I get, while I'm doing my work, maybe in a meditation or a self-reflection or something, and I find a piece of me that is ugly and detestable, and I hate her, and I can't believe I did that, and oh my God, the best way to release that is to try to love her. She was doing the best she could at the time. Have compassion for her. And the more I can do that for myself, the more set up I am to do that with other people in my life. That's a holistic approach.
Can you share a little bit more on that?
I think repressing or pushing away or resisting is the opposite of a holistic approach. That's trying to exclude something. But to the degree that we can bring something in, even if it's odious, and love it and include it, then it has less power. It becomes more neutralized to the degree that we can be inclusive of it instead of resistant to it. The resistance to anything gives it more power than it needs to have, even when that's parts of myself.
I heard somewhere that resistance is the cause of all suffering, something like that. I don't know who said that, but.
Yeah, and I think I've heard it as desire. You want something or you don't want something. They're both the same thing, right?
Yeah.
And those are both the opposite of acceptance.
Yeah, and the other easy bumper sticker one is what we resist persists.
Exactly, yeah.
So what sort of things have you embraced? What sort of things have you embraced rather than resisted?
I will try not to cuss, but I was recently in a group meditation and the leader asked us to feel in our bodies the last time that we were a jerk. I'll say the word jerk. And so recalling that moment, and I won't get into the specifics because I still have some shame about around that, but feeling that in my body and knowing that that's in me and that informs how I approach other people when they're jerks to me. This was something that happened many years ago that I did that I'm ashamed of. I have a lot of shame around it. And to the degree that I can love that girl who did a really mean thing and look at her reasons why, where she was in the moment, what motivated her to do that, that sense of separation she must have felt, and then love her in spite of her bad behavior. That was a small breakthrough moment for me. And the next moment in the guided meditation, the leader had us imagine a time when we had done something very generous, very kind, very loving. So to notice those two distinct feelings in your body that you have about yourself when you're imagining those two parts of us. I mean, both of those are me. Both of those are my experiences. Both of those I hold in my body. But to be able to look at them and incorporate them to actively, consciously incorporate both of those experiences into my body and my psyche, I think was very healing, very releasing. And, you know, I don't know what the ripple effects will be, but I think I came out of it more whole and more loving than before that moment.
I often name check a book called The Power Versus Force by David Hawkins. Have you heard of that book?
Mm-mm, have not.
He has it's a great book about consciousness, and he has a scale of human consciousness that goes from 0 to 1,000, and 0 is dead, 20 is shame, 180 is pride, unconditional love is 500, I think. He calibrates all sorts of different things on this scale. He even calibrates the wag of a dog's tail. Right. And the 180, I often mention this, the 180, the pride thing is the score that the United States Marine Corps calibrates at, right? Mm-hmm. So you take a kid who's come from a really tough background where there's a lot of shame, there's a lot of anger, there's a lot of violence. They find that they escape to the route out is into the into the army and into the militaries. But 200 is the level, below 200 is life detracting, and above 200 is life affirming. So they score at 180 because despite all that, the progress that person has made, one of their jobs, if it comes to it, is they might have to kill somebody. You know?
Yeah.
But shame is 20.
Mm-hmm.
And so for me, how I stack this up with parenting, given that I'm not, me and my wife haven't got any kids, it's like the sending to your room stuff, the naughty step, you know, the shame. It's a killer emotion. It's a killer emotion because it's the lowest thing that this guy calibrates, other than death.
And shame has been used in human communities since there have been human communities to get behavioral compliance.
Yes.
And it's unfortunate because the effect on our psyche, as you say, it makes us so low. It comes from a place of separation, smallness, and the ways that we go about recovering ourselves can be really detrimental to the group. I mean, adoption is a big piece of this. All of the policies from the 20th century were based on shame and secrecy.
Yeah.
You know, it was such a shame to be conceived out of wedlock that we had to protect that baby from that shame by hiding their records and pretending like the adoption hadn't happened. And the shame of becoming pregnant out of wedlock was so big that she could bring down her entire family. The family would would be willing to send her away. They would eschew their love for their daughter in order to not bring that shame on the family. This was like a mass hysteria, at least here in the US, of what did to avoid shame.
My birth mother was sent away.
Mm-hmm.
So I was born, she was sent away just over the border from England into Wales and onto a little island, you know, and then back to the mainland to it. But, mm-hmm. you know, I was born probably 30, 40 miles away from where she lived. And when she's feeling, you know, the whole thing is about, you talked about connection, and this whole thing is about disconnection.
Exactly.
And the religious, the stuff, the degree to which it's embedded in some religions, and some branches of some religions, I'm not going to mention any,
religions are not exempt from using shame to get behavior compliance. In fact, they're at the forefront. They have been historically.
I went to the Vatican. Rome's one of my favorite cities. I've been a few times. I went to the Vatican and I saw people. I'm sorry if this offends anybody. That started, so I'll finish. I saw somebody kissing like a concrete foot or a statue, stone foot.
Mm-hmm.
And I was shocked, and shocked wasn't the right word, but there was one of the popes. He's got his own private army, hasn't he? The Swiss Guard. He saw my disdain with this statue, this foot, somebody kissing a foot. And he gave me one of the most evil looks I've ever had in my life.
Hmm. Shame on you for not honoring our tradition.
Yeah. He knew that I was, yeah. Yeah, that's very insightful. You put it far more politely than I would have done. But yeah, it's that control thing.
And back to, you know, adoption and how we have done it and what we're coming out from under. That shame guided us to pretend like something big hadn't happened, that the woman and maybe the man hadn't had a childectomy. You know, she was supposed to forget about it, never think about it again. That which we resist persists. The child was supposed to never wonder about their origins. Adoption isn't a big deal, so they'll never think about it. And adoptive parents, you don't need to figure out how to deal with this because there's nothing to deal with. So let's just all pretend it didn't happen. That which we resist persists. Is it any wonder that the dysfunction of a system rooted in shame and secrecy is still, you know, arising today. We have to do it better. We have to do it without the shame, without the secrecy. We have to do it with truth and transparency. We have to do it. We have to find ways to get clarity, discernment, honesty, connection. We have to restore connection out of disconnection.
And the hopeful part of this is that it starts with us. It doesn't. Mm-hmm. I see a lot of people waiting for change or trying to force change, coming from anger to force change, and that they're just going to get, they just, I've been told by somebody, Joy, she was on one of the early episodes of the podcast. She's an advocate for adoption here in the UK. Her episode, I put a link to it, actually, it's a stunning one. She was found alive next to her dead twin sister in the bush in Africa. On a you know, during a war in Africa, and adopted to the UK. But she was telling me about some advocacy work, and if we go, and she said that as soon as the politicians here in the UK, and what we see from what we see, you know, on the television, it's the same in the US. There's quite a lot of childishness in the politicians. Quite a lot of acting out, and quite a lot of anger, quite a lot of division. If, and within you know, the Congress or within the Houses of Parliament, it's tolerated. You know, they tolerate it amongst themselves. But if somebody comes in trying to advocate for change, if there's the slightest bit of anger, they just get shut down. So if you're looking to advocate, don't come from there. Don't come from anger. And the, you know, most of this conversation, we've been talking all about us. You know, it's, this starts with us. We don't need to wait for the system to change. We need to see how it has affected people in the past, and then we need to just do the coming from a place of wholeness and open-heartedness. We do what? Fine, you know, what did you say? You found, from that place of peace, I get the intuitive hit of what to do next.
Right. My sister and I have created something in the yoga space called the Root to Rise Yoga Teaching Method. And we called ourselves Root to Rise because it's a yoga term. There's something called tree pose, and it kind of is tied in with that. It's applicable here because what you're saying is that the more we can root ourselves first, the better the branches and the leaves, the stronger, the more resilient, the more impactful they will be in the world. If we don't do that rooting first, that moment of peace, that moment of clarity, if we go straight to, I'm going to affect change without also doing the part through our trunk and roots into the earth, you know, really rooting in something and grounding in the ground, in the earth, then it's just not going to be as effective. And it's iterative. It's not like you do this once, you root and you ground, and then you go out and spread whatever it is, vibration you want to spread in the world. You're always rooting so that you can rise, and you root and you rise, and you root and you rise.
Yeah.
And it's a cycle.
And you're talking about rooting and rising in your home and in the world.
Yeah. As a human, you're doing both. You're rooting in yourself. You're knowing yourself. You know, Socrates said, know thyself. And then you're interacting with others, with the world. That's the rising. if you do just one part, you're lopsided.
Yeah. So I've heard that Socrates quote. I loved it. My question, the question that's playing a lot on my mind is, what does he mean by self? What is it?
I think that's part of the inquiry. It's more about the process of knowing yourself than it is about the product of, okay, today I know who self is. It's all been revealed. Now I have a concrete picture of self.
Yeah.
It's the process. It's the doing it every day or every whatever.
Yeah. This Rupert Spira guy that I was talking about, he calls part of his process self-inquiry. So. Mm-hmm. That feels like a great place to bring it in.
Yeah.
So check out the show notes for links to Laurie's book and her blog and her podcast. And if you're listening, if you're still listening now, you must have liked something that she said. So go out and check out her book or check out what else she's doing. And thank you very much, Laurie.
Thank you, Simon. It's been a pleasure talking with you.
Absolute pleasure. Thanks a lot. Thank you, listeners. Goodbye.